From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue in cluttered, ordered Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are level design and HUDs. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start. Otherwise known as heads-up displays.
Yes.
Just a little extra context for our listeners.
Yes. Yes. How do you spell HUDs? Do you put an apostrophe between the D and the S?
No, because it doesn't belong to the heads-up display.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I put apostrophes in there, though. I don't know why I did.
Well,
this is probably why you hate them so much.
I knew it.
I mean, sometimes you put them for adjective or to like, not adjectives. What's it called? The thing where you're abbreviations, right? To like distinguish between the abbreviation and the S?
Yeah, because
it's probably not correct.
No, you always do it when you have a, what are the, conjugations, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you always do it when you have, not a conjugation, that's not
contractions.
That. Right, so of course it stands for heads up display is.
Yeah.
So.
That's dumb.
Preview for the coming attractions.
Yes. Yeah. We don't have a lot to talk about at the top, but a couple of things. Mm-hmm. The big fan convention convergence just happened, at least on our, where we're sitting. And
Marina Zurtis signed my sketchbook and said that I should be an artist for a living.
That's awesome.
So I'm very happy.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a couple of cool guests there. It's the first time I've ever gone to this thing. People local to Minneapolis probably like it's a famous convention. It's like huge. It takes over an entire hotel. Mm-hmm. And it's all just like
two hotels.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And I think they're like the hotel's finally had enough and they're like moving to a new location. It's like a lot of drama with that. Mm. But I went this year with Glitch. Glitch did a thing called Playtest Arcade. And where they had a bunch of local games. So I had Widget's Hatchel there. Martha, you showed off Clawbreaker. And there was a couple other games there as well. And we did like three events on a Saturday. And we moved around the convention and set up shop in different places for like an hour and a half.
That's interesting.
And just, you know, pulled out our laptops and we had no access to power and we just like, you know,
played until the laptop battery died.
Yeah, exactly.
Switched out for a new laptop.
Yeah. I don't know. Martha, we haven't talked about it since it happened. Did you have a good time? Did you get good feedback? And
On the game? Yeah. I mean, I didn't get very much feedback.
Well, I mean, I guess Clawbreaker's done. It's got a release date. It's ready to go.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a play test. It was more of a like, hey, this game's coming out.
On August 16th.
Yeah.
Just to remind everybody. But people had, you know, the usual suggestions like, are there going to be more crabs and will there be four player?
Yeah.
Which is like the two comments we get
people
most
ask
often.
About four player?
Oh, yeah. Like every time.
What is your thought on that?
We probably won't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, irrespective of whether you're going to do it or not. Like.
I always thought of it as a fighting game, so I wouldn't, like, it would probably get too chaotic on the screen to have four, but
I think it's probably, the way it's designed, I think you'd have one or two players get knocked out real quick.
Yeah.
And in then a way that might not feel fair. Right. Mm-hmm. I think, one-on-one's probably its best mode. Although, I mean, you know, you guys are done with the thing. Like, you want to move on, but like, it wouldn't be it'd be an interesting thing to try to see if it was interesting.
That's true. I mean, there was the bug that made you have infinite crabs on your side, which is pretty great.
Yeah. I don't know how I would feel about four player. Yeah, I think that the levels are just too small for that to be the case. If the levels were larger, then it would be a little bit better. Because then you can have like 1v1s in sections of the map.
Yeah.
But we don't really have that in place right now because it wasn't designed for four player.
That's, you know, that really does remind, there's a category of suggestions you get from playtesters, which are like, that's interesting, but that's not what this game is.
Yeah.
And it's kind of difficult to like explain that to someone without you accidentally telling them, no, your idea is dumb.
Yeah.
Because it's not dumb. It's just like,
it's just different.
They don't have the context of it. They haven't done all the things you're thinking. Mm-hmm. And those conversations can be kind of tricky. And I had a couple of those.
What did they suggest?
Mostly things like, you should always be able to jump higher. Or like, it would be really great if you could just like you know, swing your tail and destroy all these bots all the time. And just like, basically, like, I want more power fantasy in this game. It's like, great, but then it's not a challenge anymore.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, that's what the game we're making.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Normally, I just like, hey, thanks for the feedback. And that's it. Uh-huh. when I get feedback like that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, because like you said, they're not bad ideas. They're just not right for the game that you're making.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I got to say, it was, we've play tested Widget Satchel here at Glitch at playtest events. We've, mm-hmm. you know, given it to some people to say, hey, try this out. And we've gotten a lot of good feedback that way. But this was like the biggest playtest the game has had.
Yeah.
And in its most sort of complete state. There are like 2.5 full levels, and a lot of the mechanics are in place, and the sort of core of it is done, and there are not so many bugs that have ruined anyone's experience. There were a fair number of them. Mm-hmm. So I did get a lot of really, really good feedback.
That's good.
And we went over the notes right, this yeah. week, and some really good stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very useful. I can't say I had a great time at Convergence otherwise. I had to buy a pass, so it's a full 4-day thing. So I was just there. I was like, I'm going to make best of my time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, eh, it's not really for me.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. It's a big social activity. Like people who get into it really get into it. And I'm like, I'm walking around, I'm like, wow, these people are having a great time. I'm so happy for them. I wish I could be as happy as these people
yeah.
are. It just was not totally for me.
Yeah. Martha, you like explored Convergence though too, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, I was planning on going before Glitch was like, let's do this. Mm-hmm.
Had you been before?
I had been to the precursor to Convergence. Uh-huh. So back when it was called Minicon.
This is like when you were very young.
Yes, this was 20 years ago because Convergence is 20 years old this year. So at least 20 years ago, I was a little kid and my parents took me with them. And it was really fun. And my brother yelled things at the stage during the masquerade. And I bought a dragon doll at the dealer's room. And it was really fun. And I almost believed that Vulcans were real because there's a guy walking around with Spock ears. And I thought they were real just for 1 second, I believe. But yeah, it was so interesting because that was huge drama. Like, speaking of con drama, like mm-hmm. when it split. It's split into three conventions, Convergence being one of them. And I tried to, people were like, oh, this is your first year. And I was like, well, actually. But yeah, it was it's quite different from what I remember. Well, it's different and the same than I remember. Mm. I felt like it should have felt bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But like it just grew proportionally to how large I was. So like when I was little, it seemed really big because I was tiny. Mm-hmm. And now it's way bigger than it used to be, but I'm also an adult. So yeah. But yeah, I had a good time. I know both you and me, Mark, mm-hmm. have gripes with the panel quality.
Yeah. I mean, Martha and I are used to like professional conventions and conferences, and not that it promises anything, it wasn't.
No, it didn't. You know? Like, I had to like dial back what I my expect, because the first panel I went to was called Agriculture Science for, it was like advances in agriculture science. I was like, ooh, here, other people are here for the party, but I'm here for the meat of the science stuff. And then I get to this panel and it's like, here's this popular science that I pulled directly from my corporate flyer / John Oliver.
Yeah.
Like, cool. Right. Yeah. This is not a conference. This is a convention.
Yeah. My wife Dale went with Glitch as a volunteer, and so she got a free pass. And so she did a bunch of the fan panels for all the things that she was interested in. And mm-hmm. she had a similar kind of like, yeah, there were just people up there who liked a thing. They didn't have any expertise. They didn't particularly know what they were talking about. They were just up there like having a conversation with your friends, but you were presenting it to an audience of like 50 people. And it took some getting used to.
Kind of sounds like a podcast.
Well, yeah, but like we know what we're talking about.
Right.
I think that casual nature is one of its strengths.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just like it took some getting used to for
me. Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though I didn't go to Convergence, it sounds like it was still fun.
It was so much, like, there was so much to do and so many people in really great costumes. Like, was the best part, was just standing up at the balcony and looking down at the big atrium area where all people with just like amazing costumes. You're like, oh my God, there's that person from that show. And oh my God, it's a Klingon. And oh my God.
It's like 70% of the attendees were in costume.
Yeah.
It's like a definitely huge tradition at that one. And what's great is because the convention's been, it's going on for 20 years, there are people who went when they were young 20 years ago and they're still going. So it's this huge, like a big wide audience of people, which means you get age appropriate cosplay. So you see like the perfectly correct age Alan Grant from Jurassic Park just like walking around. Like,
wow, that's awesome.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. There was the old lady was there dressed as the grandma from Moana.
Nice.
Oh, wow. Dang. I'm sad. I missed all that. That's cool.
Yeah, so I definitely felt like an anthropologist, like walking through because it just didn't seem like for me, but it was so cool. It was, mm-hmm. it was great, you know.
There was a couple with a baby that were two rebel Star Wars rebels from Endor, and the baby was as Ewok, like a little Ewok.
Oh,
they
wow.
were carrying off. It's pretty good.
That's good.
Anyway, there's another podcast.
Oh, yeah.
That we should mention.
Yeah. So I threw this in the notes. So my wife, Dale, and a friend of the show, Felix.
He's been on a couple times.
Yep. Both have been on this show a few times. They are starting another podcast that I'm just going to use this space to promote. So Felix, some background. Felix and I go to the Marvel movies whenever they come out. And sometimes we drag Dale along, but like very rarely, she just is loath to it. Mm-hmm. And what will happen is Felix and I will talk about these movies. We're like, we claim not to care about them that much, but like we spend way too much time talking about them. It's really embarrassing. And like Felix will start talking to Dale about them, mm-hmm. and Dale will just be like just engage him in a weird way. And so we thought, well, let's bottle that. So the podcast is Felix drags Dale through the Marvel Universe. And it's a 20-episode series of every one of these Marvel movies. And it's where they watch the movie and they just recap it. And it because Dale doesn't care about these movies and doesn't really want to engage with them on the level that they want you to engage with them,
yeah.
you hear the most interesting nitpicks coming from her. That you've never, I swear it's very unique and interesting. And the two of them are like a blast together. And so look for that. I think when this episode comes out, the first few of that podcast will be out in maybe out a week or so. So we'll put there'll be a website probably by the time this is out. I'm half promising. So check the notes on this episode for that. And we'll talk about it again probably in the next episode to hype it up.
Maybe we can slip in a clip here of the.
Oh, yeah. That's a super good idea. We totally did that just now. I think.
Where it shoots up into the air and blasts Tony, but he's fine. And then also blasts Obadiah and he dies.
Okay, so we'd never see Obadiah again?
Never see Obadiah again.
Okay, but Tony's totally okay.
He yeah. Obadiah. The Obadiah. Which brings me to this amazing statistic I just read yesterday, that Pepper Potts kills 11% of the villains in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The first 10 minutes of this very long fight scene in yep. the soda factory, they do not show the Hulk. He's in the shadows, and you get like oh, a yeah. little glimpse of him like the whole time.
Is that how they saved money?
I'm assuming that's forever. How they save money on the budget. This is also where I noticed that everything that can be green in this movie is green.
They arrest Whiplash somehow.
Yes.
And then he goes to prison, where we learn about prison in Monaco.
Yes.
So I looked this up because I was like, how can this tiny city state have this prison? It is not a member of the European Union, not part of France. They have their own prison capacity that is 82 prisoners. You're laughing because I already told you my joke, which is, so I have a proposal for an Oceans sequel. I call it Oceans 83. They can't send all of us to prison.
Sounds like they're bringing podcasting to the next level.
Yeesh.
This is Greg Martha for your transition. Awesome.
Bringing in a pinch hitter to
yes.
real good. Okay, so this is our first topic, level design. This is my topic, and I wanted to talk about it because working on Widget Satchel, uh-huh. and it's a single player platformer game with a lot of level design, more than any game I've ever made. And so just thinking about that, you know, recently, like how to employ that and like sort of learning things I already knew, if that makes sense, where as I'm if you watch like a lot of like the YouTube videos on these things, like the Mark Brown, the Game Designer's Toolkit,
right? Yeah,
you know these things, like you hear, you know, like, oh yeah, I've heard this analysis, I've read these things, or I've had these own thoughts as I play games. But then as you start putting it together, you have these same ideas again, mm-hmm. and it is learning it new again. It's very interesting. So I thought we'd chat about it on good examples and bad examples. There's a couple of really good articles about this. There's a great one called The 10 Principles of Good Level Design. Mm. And so I'm going to, a couple of my little topic headers are going to be pulled from that. So we'll put a link for that in the show notes and you can check out the way that's done. But this is sort of a little bit of a remix of that idea. So the first thing that I want to talk about is that level design is really about building a language.
Yeah, totally.
From parts. And it doesn't matter if it's like a 2D game, like a Mario game, or if it's like a 3D open world kind of realistically.
Like a Mario game.
That's pretty much all we're going to be talking about. And I got to say, it is actually really hard when you're like researching and thinking about level design to not just distill it through all of Mario.
Yeah,
kind of. Because there's kind of examples everywhere. Like, and we talked about this in the sequels episode where like Mario gets to be everything now. Like part of its core is that it gets to like be unique and different with each iteration.
Yeah.
And therefore it gets to touch every corner of this, like this topic. Yeah. And like the Mario 1-1, like the original Super Mario Brothers, is such a famous example of good level design that you tend to start thinking there. And then you're like, well, what other Mario examples? Anyway, so we'll touch on a lot of those, of course. But the idea is you build a language from parts. And using iterative design and some surprising elements. So you use your level to explain to a player how the world works. This is such and such high, which is a normal platform, or this is too high, mm-hmm. Or, you know, explaining what like, what spikes look like, what enemies are, like, explaining it visually, but also like compositionally. This is kind of just defining it. It's not that insightful, but it's, I think the thing that a lot of, especially platformer games, the ones that are not great, are ones that just use the language of platformer games and don't develop their own language. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I was trying to think of examples. The ones that work really, really well are ones where they set their own world. And Mario is, of course, the best example of that.
Right?
Where like the idea that you jump on an enemy is like I don't know if it's a Mario invention, but like it's so standard that you have to, it almost feels like a subversion if you don't do that now. So a lot of the things you think of as platformer language are just really Mario language.
Yeah. You know, now that I think about it, I think this is sort of an aside, but like the original, I think I played Super Mario Brothers before I played the original Mario Brothers. But like in the original Mario Brothers, you could not jump on enemies.
Right.
And I think I tried to do that and failed. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
It's a Mario game. So
I think a lot of people played the original Mario Brothers. So if people don't know, it's a single screen arcade style game.
Yeah.
It's Mario versus Luigi. And it was an arcade game. It was an NES game as well before Super Mario Brothers, at least in Japan. And there was that a lot of people are familiar with that through a bonus mode in Mario Brothers 3, where you can compete if you're like on the same card on a map. You can go into the classic Mario Brothers mode and compete.
Oh yeah.
And I think that is where people were really confused because it was, I think, a pretty faithful recreation of the rules of the original Mario Brothers, which are not the same.
They're so different.
Yeah, and it's a little strange.
Yeah.
But that is where the punching up from below mechanic comes from.
Right.
So in order to knock an enemy out in the original Mario Brothers, you had to be underneath the platform and you'd jump up and you'd knock them out. Mm-hmm. And that is where, and that carried over Super Mario Brothers where it's breaking blocks and stuff. And one of the things that's fun for people to learn is that Mario doesn't hit these things with his head. He actually punches them with his fist.
Yeah.
And it's because it's so quick, you don't really notice it. That's always fun to tell people they don't know that already.
Yeah, but that's an interesting, the whole series before Super Mario Brothers is like an iteration process.
Yep.
You have Donkey Kong where he just jumps over stuff.
Yeah.
And then you have Mario Brothers where he jumps over stuff and then hits things under it. And then you have Super Mario Brothers where you can also jump on the things and you use that to navigate the world a lot more.
Yeah.
Like it's all an extension of that. And the level design is clear about it. So like they had experience with the first few games and they got to this point.
Yeah.
Based off of that.
Yeah. And the thing that what makes Super Mario Brothers so great is that it uses that iterative process that's now kind of like, you know, to where it was at that point. And then all the levels are built using, like, really leveraging all those components.
Yeah.
So, like, the Hammer Brother is only really an interesting enemy because jumping on them is incredibly hard because they throw hammers up.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so you have to be more deliberate, right? And the bloopers are, underwater are also more of a threat because I don't think you can't jump on them.
No.
You can only shoot them if you have a fire flower. So, and the fire flower is diagonal. And so, like, all these little pieces of the way it works and that the way that Mario's toolkit is interesting. But they're all kind of arbitrary choices. It's the level design that makes them sing. You know,
yeah.
Actually, like, leverages them correctly, like how far a jump is, or the fact that when Mario runs, Mario can go over one unit gaps. Right? There's elements in the original Mario Brothers that play on those things, as well as elements that subvert those expectations a little bit. Mm-hmm. A lot of them in the original Japanese Super Mario Brothers 2, oh, to the point where it kind of ruined that game.
Yep.
And we talked about that on this show before.
Yep.
But yeah, the idea of, like, having
stupid poison mushrooms.
But really, it's mechanics.
Oh, they're a different color.
That game made me mad too.
Sorry, keep going.
No, this is great color commentary. No, but that's exactly right. Like, you don't want to. It's that level of trust. You give the player this language, and then they have to trust you that you will be fair with them, mm-hmm. right? The mechanics in Mario are fine, but it's really the level design that make them work.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I think that's the case with a lot of platformers, really.
I think
and
so.
Like,
yeah,
it's probably the case in, like, games in general. Like, you have a set of mechanics,
yeah,
but you need a level to put them together and for the player mm-hmm. to be able to explore them and experience them.
And that's when that's why open world games are the ones that probably fail this test the most, is because their level designs tend to it tends to be really easy to break an open world game,
right?
Because, like, the level design does not constrain itself around the game mechanics necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, like, the Grand Theft Auto games are a great example of this. Is like, those games are they cannot be difficult because they give you too much to do in a world where you can do anything.
Right. Yeah. The open world aspect of it is real. The missions themselves are designed.
Well, that's the thing, is a lot of times they are, but they have to live in this open world and they tend to fight it a little bit.
Yeah.
So some open world games do a good job of, like, drawing those boundaries when they need to be drawn, and some are not great at that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's kind of difficult. But then open world games is a case where players aren't necessarily looking for great level design always.
Also true.
Right? There's, like, a different a metric that you judge its quality or its success on. And I think that's something interesting, too, is, like, a bad level design doesn't always break a game.
Yeah.
Like, there are some good games with bad level design.
Right. I was like, I was struggling to come up with a game example that wasn't, like, an open world game that had bad level design that I wanted to bring up on the show.
The one I don't like very much, and I think that I don't think this is a common opinion, but I feel like I'll have some backers, is, like, the 2D Sonic games, I don't think have great level design.
I would agree with that.
They have this great game feel, like when you're moving your way quickly through a level. It has these branching paths. A lot of it's very interesting, but visually it's cacophonous, and it doesn't. When your rhythm is halted, then suddenly the game is totally different.
Yeah,
and it doesn't give you any signposts or what to do. It has all these little things like springs and enemies and, like, collapsing platforms and moving, like, all these, it has a bunch of parts.
Yeah.
But none of it makes any sense unless you're moving at, like, super speed, and then you only see 5% of it. So, like, I feel I've never felt very comfortable, like, saying, oh, that level is great. It's always that level looks cool, or the music was great, or maybe that was just fun to blaze through.
Yeah.
But there's very little memorable about, like, moments and sections, because there's just so much of these little things.
Yeah, I was playing Sonic Mania with my brother because he has it on the Switch.
Yeah.
Some of the levels in there are, like, based off the old, like, literally the old levels, I think. Maybe updated a little bit.
And yeah.
Then some of them are like remixed versions of the same thing. And both of those I just did not like. Did not like going through those levels at all.
Yeah.
And I realized that, like, a lot of the Sonic games I didn't think had good level design in the first place. The first one, it just felt like it was just like a start and stop sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you'd go really fast for a moment, and then you'd have to do, like, a short platforming thing, and you have to be really slow and meticulous about your movements.
Yeah.
And to me, that's not what Sonic is. Sonic, to me, is about, like, keeping your momentum going and constantly keeping that up and figuring out ways to do it. And when like your momentum halts, it feels bad.
Yeah.
But like the game is designed, or the levels are like, at least are designed in a way that you have to halt your momentum to deal with certain obstacles.
Right. And I think there's some Sonic levels that are like that. Mm-hmm. And I think they're meant to be a little different than other types of Sonic levels.
Yeah.
But Sonic is a machine and they can only work one way.
Yeah.
And it starts to feel weird.
Yeah. Well, the first one has a lot of egregious cases about this, I think. But like the later ones, there are more about like there are different paths. And if you go in the if you go to the worst path, then you have to be slower about it. But the higher paths, you can keep going. You just have to know where they're at.
Yeah.
And so those feel a little bit better. And I think Sonic Mania was trying to get to that point, but like it, I don't know. It didn't hit it for me.
Yeah, my favorite level in all of Sonic's is probably Chemical Plant Zone?
Yeah.
In Sonic 2. And
it's got that good music.
And it's got good music. It's got a lot of different variety. It looks cool. But I honestly couldn't, I don't know what it is. Like, I couldn't draw it. Like, yeah. I don't know what the beginning is. It has no sense of pacing. And I think that's where it kind of, and it's because of the way the game is designed, it has to be that way. Mm. Like, and that's the thing, Sonic is still a good game. Like, I'm not like there are parts that are not great that we're describing, but I would still say that doesn't ruin it. Mm-hmm. But I just, the levels are not memorable in that way. Like the theming, the milieu of it, and some of the little pieces, but like you could remix, and Sonic Mania does, but you could take all the sections of my favorite Sonic levels and randomize them completely, and I would not know the difference. Mm, mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have a sense of that, and I find that kind of strange. And that's definitely the where Mario really shines, is where you can see these little heat maps of, sections of Mario levels that are safe and sections that are dangerous, right? Yeah. They have, like, pits or whatever. And you can, for a Mario level, you can see, like, the how it goes back and forth between, like, safe areas and unsafe areas, and then and you can see, like, oh, this is a little longer, and then the pacing is just so well done in a lot of these. Like Mario levels can be long or short, mm-hmm. Where Sonic levels kind of doesn't matter how long they are, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a Sonic fan who like knows this better than we do.
Right,
who could probably make a case for it.
I didn't grow up with, well, I played Sonic games when I was younger, but like I think I was a bit older at that point and I had already played a bunch of Mario games. Yeah. And they're like very different. So.
I was a Genesis kid. Ah. Like Sonic was my game when I was young. I did have an original Nintendo, but I didn't have a Super Nintendo. So like in the Mario versus Sonic 90s war, I was like on Sonic's team. But I think because of advertisements, I don't think because of any other reason. But like, so Sonic was the one I preferred as a child. And so I'd like to think I have some credibility when I say that it's not as memorable now, you know? Okay, so enough bashing on that.
Well, okay. What about like racing games and stuff? Because platformers aren't the only things mm-hmm. that need level design.
Yeah, they're the easiest to talk about in these terms, mm-hmm. for sure.
They're the thing you think about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Martha, when we were coming up with the examples, one of the ones you had was Hydro Thunder Hurricane.
Hydro Thunder Hurricane!
Which is a racing game that your boyfriend Dylan is like top tier in the world at.
28, I think.
Dang.
On certain maps.
Nice. So you've seen many, many playthroughs of this, so you're very familiar.
Yeah. And I think what's so great about the levels of Hydro Thunder is like they're just so well themed, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a level where you're going through like Area 51, mm-hmm. and you start off in like this normal seeming landscape, and then you go into this like facility.
Yeah.
And there's like all along the walls, there's like alien like pods and stuff like that, and then you go through this portal and then you're in this like alien landscape world with like weird tentacle things coming out of the walls and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So cool.
Yeah. Like the whole track tells a story.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. That's the thing that I think with level design, I think people tend to treat as a separate thing, which is environmental storytelling, mm-hmm. Which can, I think level design is something that people don't leverage enough for that.
Yeah.
And that's a great example where it's not just the styling, but like you said, like you go through little portals and stuff and like that. And like a racing game mechanics are not that complicated. Like no racing game is that complicated, although I'm sure there it's deep, you know, but, but
there's
like
six strats.
Yeah. but like the different kinds of ways that you know, different, just like ramps or all, like the little things you can theme to a level to sort of like separate them out and leverage the storytelling that you use and that sort of aesthetic parts of it as well, right?
Yeah. Like there's a mechanic on a couple levels that all are like take place in cities where mm-hmm. like police boats chase you because you're having a legal boat race in the canals of Paris or something.
Yeah. Right.
Or in the sewers or mm-hmm. whatever.
That's the thing that impressed me a lot about that game. Though, like, when Dylan plays it, he, like, breaks half of it, so I don't get a lot of... And, I mean, that's fine. But, when you just have to play through it, I guess, legitimately, then, like, you see the story being told throughout the race. And the way that Hydro Thunder races go is, like, you just go from start to finish. There's no laps. So, like, they don't have to keep telling the same story over and over.
Some of them are laps.
Oh, some of them have laps? Oh. Well, then never mind.
A lot of the ones that are more storytelling, like, don't.
Okay.
Like, there's one that's in the Bermuda Triangle. There's a lot of, like, like conspiracy theory-esque maps. But there's one in the Bermuda Triangle where you start off, like, in this normal, like, boat race. And then suddenly you get sucked down a whirlpool. And then you're in this, like, ship graveyard and you have to jump over all these like aircraft carriers that are half sunk into the ground or in the water and stuff. Yeah, it's so cool.
You know, another game that's I'm sure people listening are already thinking of that does something similar is Mario Kart.
Mm. Oh yeah.
Particularly Mario Kart 8, which some of those are non-lapped levels. And they have a lot of these sort of like act structures. They tell stories.
Yeah.
But that, again, environmental storytelling and then leveraging mechanics. Right. And this is the thing about Hollow Knight.
Yeah.
Hollow Knight has great environmental storytelling, but it doesn't really use its mechanics in an interesting way to leverage that. The different worlds feel different because the different enemies that are there.
Yeah.
And not because of the way the levels are designed necessarily, which isn't, that's not that those aren't similar or related, but I found that a little bit sort of frustrating.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like a lot of the story of the world in each section of the map is based off of the enemies you're fighting.
Yeah.
But where that
game is like a total triumph in that area is that each area does really feel like a different environment. Not just visually, but like the music, and then when you unlock the subway system, you can get extra commentary about each world, and then as you find inhabitants of the above ground and you send them back up there, you can go back up, and then they can tell more about how they got lost, and like the world is better for you having been there when you hear about someone else talking about it. So that does a really great job. And even though a lot of that is outside of the mechanics of the game, the design of the levels really like make that feel better, like make it feel more real. Mm-hmm. And I really like that about it. I do sometimes wish though that it was that, but I could remember like the mechanical experience being leveraged a little better in those elements.
Yeah.
But it still does a lot more than most games do.
True. Yeah. My favorite part in design in general is really when you can tell a story just because of how the mechanics work. And
stuff.
And so like the racing examples that Martha you brought up, and just like in Hollow Knight where like you have to deal with enemies differently depending on what area you're in, like that can tell the player a lot about how the world works too.
Yeah.
I think that like we should do more to do better with that.
Yeah.
Because I think that's important.
Mm-hmm. A game that does that pretty well is the first Bioshock, where that's a game with relatively simple mechanics that don't change a lot as you go through the game. I mean, there's your power-ups and stuff. Mm-hmm. But each little area it has a real different feel and is sort of like the way the corridors are sized and like the way that it constrains your movement and the way that, particularly like the boss battles, it does use the design of these physical spaces. And that's one where it has to feel more like a real place, than a platformer really can get away with.
Yeah.
And I think the first Bioshock does a really good job of making Rapture feel like, even though it's a bunch of corridors with people to shoot, it still feels like it could have been a real city at one point. And then you get to like the opera house, or you get to the fish market, or whatever it is that you get to. And then the way that those even the way that those are laid out vertically change how you engage with them, and the types of enemies you encounter in there like make a lot of sense to the world building. And a lot of that level design is really, really strong in a way that like for example, BioShock Infinite, not great at. Because I will use every opportunity when I praise BioShock to like beat up on BioShock Infinite, because that game just feels samey the whole way around. Like every zone feels the same, you know. Even though it had probably a stronger like sense of place than the first BioShock did, like in terms of what the story really was, like how much meat there was on that bone.
Yeah,
but it didn't really deliver to you in a way that the first BioShock totally
did. The
meat
wasn't lean.
Yeah. I knew I'd regret that metaphor. The Arkham games, the Batman Arkham games, also do a pretty good job of each sort of, and then these like set pieces, right? And that's what I really like about like the 3D games with those realistic art styles. I think really good level design in there can a lot of times revolve around these set pieces.
Yeah.
And that's where open world games can make it work for them, is when they take you to a place and then they lock you in. Like it's a little artificial in that sense. It breaks, but it allows you to then do more with the level design. The Arkham games are ostensibly open world, but they don't feel open world. They feel like you can play the sections in any order, but they feel episodic. More so than
they feel open world, and to me in the same way that like Grand Theft Auto feels, in that like you can do everything you want, but like when you want to go to the story, there it is.
Yeah,
that's I guess that's how I feel. That made it sound more negative than I intended. Yeah. But that's how.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think the story is a lot stronger, and then the drive to push you to it.
Yeah,
whereas Grand Theft Auto really encourages you to just goof off forever.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And that's like a strength of that game, right? Is you can just ignore the story. Whereas I think if you do that in the Arkham games, there you'll quickly run out of stuff to do.
And they keep reminding you constantly, hey, there's these things you got to do.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I got it. But I got to save other people too.
Listen. Right? Hey. Listen.
That's my favorite type of open world game is one that is like, it doesn't let you just goof around.
Oh yeah.
It actually does doesn't bother you. It actually properly motivates you to move through the story.
Oh no, yeah. I'm making it sound way worse than I mean to, but like, yeah, like they bother you in the way that like, this is important and you need to do it, and you're Batman. Somebody needs to save these people.
Yes.
And I'm like, I'm trying to save other people too.
Yeah.
That's all.
One of the good elements of good level design from this article was about efficiency. And I know so sort of interesting, and it's efficiency in design, not just for the sake of the player understanding elements, but for the designer creating them.
Yeah.
And I thought that was sort of an interesting thing, like good level design is efficient. And it's like, well, conceptually, if you had all the time in the world, does it have to, couldn't you, you don't have to reuse a lot of elements to save time, but that is a telltale sign of good level design, is if a designer does make efficient use of the tool, of the parts they have.
Mm.
And I thought it was a really interesting take on that, that isn't just about like saving time. It's like, even if you have all the time in the world, saving time is a good sign that you've done your job well.
Yeah. Not just that, but like the player gets to explore and experience all of the things about this. If you're being efficient with it, like you get to you like squeeze out everything you can out of the level.
Yeah.
That feels good for both the player and the developer, I think.
Yep.
And that's part of why I don't like the new Super Mario Bros. Ones as much, because they feel like there's new things every level and it doesn't stick on anything.
I think this still works on that score, because I think when we're talking about efficiency, it's not just about like having as few things as possible to leverage as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Think about the way that there's some videos and articles about this four stage of level design in Mario games, which when we say Mario games, we're actually talking about games starting from Mario Galaxy. It's the influence of one of their directors. I have the name here. We'll put it in the notes because I lost it in my notes. Was a level design director on Galaxy, and then and then was the director on the new Super Mario 3D Land and 3D World games. And that's where the idea of this, where you introduce a concept, a mechanic, in a safe space, then you develop it by making a more of a challenge.
Yeah.
Then you put a twist on it, so it sort of confounds your expectations, and then you give it a conclusion. You sort of wrap it up, and then you're done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a thing that a lot of this era of Mario games did, that Mario Odyssey did not do as much of. And so it felt a little bit of a change, because people were starting to anoint this as like the Mario way.
Yeah.
But it really is just about this particular series, this smaller series of games.
Yeah.
And I think it is efficient in that same way, in that it sort of uses it does not waste any of it. Like it,
sure.
For a game with 800,000 mechanics,
yeah,
it still doesn't feel like a grab bag of stuff the way it could be. And I think that is very efficient. It's maybe not as time efficient for the designer, but in each little world, it is very, I think it is really well efficiently designed.
I mean, yeah, in each specific level, they use that one idea very well. Yeah. But there's just a lot of different ideas, and that's what I don't like about it.
Well, the thing that I do like about that, and doesn't bother me that there's so many, is because you engage with it with Mario's like jumping mechanics,
right?
And so it becomes not the new mechanic isn't like a new weapon or a new, although sometimes it's like a power up, I suppose. But it's always a twist on how you use Mario's skills that you've been using this whole game.
Yeah,
and so that's what I like about it. And the worst of the ideas are ones that are just like that are just totally new for new's sake. And there are a couple of those. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. So I mean, because that's the point about efficiency not necessarily being like a formula.
Yeah, right?
It's speaking about more of an attitude, I suppose.
Yep.
We can talk about a couple other examples, but before I get to a couple of these, there's one more sort of main topic that I think, again, another thing that Mario does really good, and then the new Super Mario Brothers games, the 2D ones, do particularly well, which is this element of risk-reward, where a level design can be as difficult as the player wants it to be, where it's like a sort of a base level of challenge, but then there are bonus elements, or there are like, there's a power-up you could go for that will make the later part of the level easier, but is more of a risk to go for now.
Yeah.
And that, like, the 2D Mario games, particularly the newer ones, are like masters of that kind of design.
I was going to say, if you want to talk about like risk-reward stuff, I would bring up Kirby.
Yeah?
Because like, Kirby games are notoriously easy if you don't go for all the collectibles. And, well, the newer ones are particularly easy, even if you do go for the collectibles.
Right.
But, like, some of the older Kirby games, like, when you try to get all the collectibles, it gets real hard. I like the way that those games are designed in that, like, if you don't want to engage in that way, and like you're saying, Rick, if you don't want to engage in that way, then you do not have to, and you can just go through a level and get through it and have a good time.
Yeah.
But if you want to, like, get all that challenge and stuff, then it's here for you.
Mm-hmm.
In a separate section. Yeah.
And that's the philosophy we're trying to do with Widget Satchel, is where in Widget Satchel, you cannot die. You cannot lose Widget Satchel. And so we want to make it so that anyone can just traipse their way through the game, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we want it to be really hard for people who want everything.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find that balance because you make a section that's kind of tricky and you're like, but wait a minute, this is suddenly now is above the level of easy that we want the easier players. And we're probably maybe demanding more of that gulf between the easy and difficult than most games of this type. So we're setting ourselves a bit higher challenge than I think a lot of games that do this kind of philosophy have.
Oh yeah, it's so hard to design for Widget Satchel, but it's fun.
It is. It's been fun. Like when it works, it's really satisfying. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I think we've gone over examples of a lot of good level designs. Have we gone over bad level design examples? We talked about Sonic.
Yeah, so I want to talk about Mario Odyssey.
Oh.
Because I think Mario Odyssey has some of the open world-itis problems. I think about like New Donk City, which like looks kind of cool. But if you kind of actually look at it like a physical object, it's like a gross ball of random shapes in a way that is not attractive.
Oh, okay.
And
are you just talking aesthetically?
No. There's more to it than that. Like it feels like The Mario does a great job of your first pass through a world telling you where to go.
Yeah.
Like, it does a really good job of that. But then, when your second pass, suddenly those signposts are removed or changed.
Mm.
It's very guided. And the level design itself is not doing the guiding. It's the sequencing and the particular, like, mission that you're on that does the guiding for you. The level itself is kind of just a blob. Like, it's just kind of a blob. And then this feels really true. Once you've, like, mastered the level and you've seen all of it, and then you go for all the remaining moons, you suddenly realize, like, how much of a blob they each are. Because you've lost all of your signposts for the different paths that you take through it.
Yeah.
And New Donk City, I think, is the best example of this because it really does, like, the scales fall from your eyes. You're like, oh, this is just a bunch of rectangles. Like, it's not even that interesting.
Okay, I found New Donk City to be the best level compared to the other ones, especially that dang ocean one. Nobody likes swimming.
Yeah, well, no one likes underwater.
I found it to be the best because, like, anywhere you look, there was something you could do, even if it was just fun stuff. It doesn't even have to be, like, there's a moon in this direction.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you could just hop around. Uh-huh. And like, I really enjoyed that. And that reminded me more of Super Mario 64, where it was just fun to run around in the level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas like some of the levels in Super Mario Odyssey, they were just gigantic, like the desert one. It was just a gigantic landmass.
Yeah,
going from place to place just took time.
Right.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really fun to maneuver around in that level. And so true. Those are the ones I had an issue with.
Yeah.
But New Donk City, like,
Oh, did I go up here? Oh, I can go get over here. Oh, look, there's that cone thing that I didn't notice before. And then, Yeah.
There's something new everywhere. And I like that.
I guess I don't disagree, particularly about Toast Arena, the desert level, because it does feel like it's just a bunch of little things in a big field, kind of. It doesn't feel that designed as much.
Yeah.
But the thing with New Donk City is it's exactly like that. It's just denser. So once you start doing like the last third of the things in there, you end up retracing your steps a million times. And you're like, oh, right, it was the other way. And so you don't get lost exactly, but you just spend a lot of time hoofing around in a way that is not fun anymore. Like the first time, fun. Mm-hmm. But then the 50th time, you're like, ugh, I just want to get to that thing.
I feel like that's the case with like everything in Super Mario Odyssey.
I suppose. But where it really draws into a sharp relief is the sections in Mario Odyssey that are behind doors or like the little tiny mini levels, which are all, especially in the post-game content, they're all genius little tiny chunks of level design, brilliant, almost entirely mechanical. So a lot of them are ugly, like they're just clearly put together with the parts they had because it's like these later challenges, but mechanically just brilliant design. But it makes you realize, oh yeah, the best parts of Mario Odyssey are not the open world parts. They're the little behind the door parts, the little tiny world parts.
Yeah, I guess those are the ones you remember.
Yeah, and it kind of makes you realize, like, oh, okay, like it is fun to go around in these worlds, but that is not what the best part of that game is. And it kind of like sours it a little bit. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess the core concept wasn't as strong as I thought. Hmm. You know,
I don't know.
Am I wrong?
I liked it.
Yeah.
Well, what did you like about the level design?
Pretty much what you like. There's always something around the corner. Mm-hmm. The little ones I've found. Sometimes those is really challenging, and so like I'll stop doing them and go and try another one. So that's why I liked the open worldness of it, because I could not do a level if I like, and I wouldn't be prevented from ever playing the game again. So
yeah. And that's one of the things that it shares with Mario 64, which is this idea of lots of little things you can do in not any order, but like many orders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that is definitely a strength of it for sure. I guess just the size of it started to be like, especially because some of those best little pieces were really, really tiny.
Yeah.
And so it really throws into sharp relief like how big those other sections are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's kind of cool to just find a moon out and about. Like that's a fun experience, I suppose.
I mean, my little cousin hardly ever went in any of, at least not when I was watching, into any of the little levels or whatever. She also plays as two player with only one, like just herself.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Which is pretty funny. She picks up the one to move the Mario and picks up the other one to move the hat. Which is pretty funny. So she can't do any of the like combo moves because she hasn't figured out how to do that yet. Oh, but,
okay. That's the pro strat though. Like that's how people do it in the speedruns. I think they play it separately like that.
So. Nice. Well, there you go.
You got a little speed runner on you.
She was so into it. Anyway, I mean, just going around the levels immersed her for hours.
Yeah.
So I call that a win.
Yeah.
But that might be just because it was the first time she was going through them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and again, Mario games are great at this, but like the idea that the worlds feel like their own little worlds, like they have their very heavily themed in a way that's pretty successful.
Yep.
Aesthetically, and I think that is a big part of level design that I think people discount as being a separate thing, but I think it matters a lot.
I mean, it's part of the mechanics too. Like if you're using you should be making sure that like the mechanics make sense for whatever level you're trying to make too, so it works both ways.
The other one that I wanted to take down a peg because it's been needed to be taken down.
Okay,
I guess is this game called Bug for a Sega Saturn that I grew up playing and I liked a lot.
Tear at it.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people are familiar with this game, so I'll have to explain it a bit. But it was this was before Mario 64, but it was in the era of the PlayStation and Saturn when like 3D games were starting.
Ah.
And so what it was a 3D platformer, sort of. And I would urge listeners to just look up some images of this because I'm not sure I'm going to describe it really well. But it was each level was a sort of a, it almost felt like a maze. Mm-hmm. That was of corridors, kind of, but they weren't hallways. They were just like platforms, sort of. And you would, I'm trying to find a way to describe this very well in a simple way, but like, yeah. It's sort of a 2.5D thing where you couldn't move around in 3D space, but the levels were arranged in 3D. Mm. So you would sort of move left and right, but then you could also move back and forward if the level went that way. And so all the mechanics were 2D. In that you, in fact, the character was a Donkey Kong Country style, was like a pre-rendered sprite.
Oh, cool.
But it was a 3D model, right? Yeah. So it was trying to really be as 3D as possible.
Yeah.
It felt like it was a 3D game, and it was like this like a great 3D game, and that was what it sold as. But that was totally a gimmick. Mm-hmm. The mechanics are not that way at all. And in a way that kind of hurt it, because the mechanics were so bland and just jumping on enemies and collecting coins, and there was almost nothing else to it. Mm. And the levels were sort of designed in these sort of like twisty, pretzel-y patterns. And so it felt like it was visually quite interesting. And for its time, graphically impressive. Mm-hmm. But like mechanically, there was nothing to it. Mm. It was just a 2D game that was folded up like origami. And I remember really liking that game, but never being able to revisit it as soon as I played any other game afterward.
Yeah.
You know? But I encourage people to look that up because it's one of those things that definitely felt innovative. It was very well reviewed for its time because it was graphically impressive and had kind of a fun attitude. It was the 90s, so everything had attitude. but like it did not age very well because it's kind of riding a trend in a sense.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think if there's other games that are like that, which sort of felt cool, felt good, but not for reasons that, like the reasons that don't fade away over time.
Sonic Adventure 2.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That game is not good.
Tell me about
Charles. Cause he swears it's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the first level in that game, you play as Sonic and you're going through the level really fast and it has a good song. Mm-hmm. Everybody remembers the song Escape from the City.
Yeah.
Escape from the City. I can't sing. But yeah, after that, you got to go through like levels where you're Knuckles and you're looking for crystals and stuff. You're not even punching people. And like, what's even the point?
Punching people.
And then, there are levels right? And then there are levels where you play as Tails and you're in a machine the whole time. You're not even playing as Tails.
Yeah.
So like, these are the things that make that game not good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's a preview of one of a rant.
Uh-huh. Sure, I will have. Sure. Well, I mean the Sonic Adventure games, it was like it's Sonic's only real 3D games, right?
And, I mean, yeah, in terms of, yeah.
So
yeah.
Did it ever find I never played those games. Mm. So like, did it ever find a sense of what it felt what its level design philosophy was? Because like the 2D Sonic games, we were, you know, talking about them earlier, they have a very specific idea of what a 2D Sonic level looks like,
right?
But every time I see clips of those games, I can't get a sense of what it is.
See, yeah, especially Sonic Adventure and Sonic Adventure 2,
yeah,
they both have a bunch of different characters in them and that you play as, and mm-hmm. they all play completely differently and they have completely different levels.
Okay,
so like it's hard to get a sense of what mm-hmm. the game is. Yeah. Everybody wants to play as Sonic,
right?
But you don't most of the time.
I mean, that sounds like a strength, though, like leveraging the mechanics in the level design, right?
Well, yeah, except that, like, in Sonic Adventure specifically, in one example, you're playing a Sonic and you're running through levels really fast and it's really cool and exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then in another level, you're playing a fishing minigame as a character, as a giant cat.
Uh-huh.
And that's the game. Like, literally, his whole story is, I got to catch this frog. So he goes to different pools and lakes and tries to catch the frog, and he catches the frog, but then the frog gets away.
Uh-huh.
Then you have to fight a boss where you just the boss is made out of water, and then you just fish in the boss
mm-hmm.
and catch the fish.
So a little bit of Whiplash then, like not didn't have its own. It just had a bunch of different identities.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I could see a game making that work, but I kind it's of understand where you're at. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just want to give you guys a heads up.
Uh huh.
That the next topic is imminent.
Wow, that was a stealth. I liked it.
Yeah, well, that was good.
Real, real good.
Didn't even see it coming. I was like, bam. Oh, man, this is a transition. Yes, HUDs.
Yeah.
Heads-up displays.
Uh-huh.
As was identified earlier
mm-hmm.
in the episode. They suck. Don't put them in your hand.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
That's it. Cool. Third topic. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So obviously I'm on the end of the spectrum where like I'm like, get rid of all of the HUDs.
Yeah.
Because they're just in the way. But I mean, I can't say that for all games. And frankly, I play fighting games and those have HUDs. So like,
you say you can't say that for all the games, but according to your notes.
No, don't call me out. Yeah, I just said get rid of your HUDs. Mm-hmm. Not everything needs to be on the screen.
Yeah.
Some things do. Some things are important and necessary. Like, for example, in a fighting game, you need to know how much health you have and how much health your opponent has. And you need to be really clear about it because you make decisions based off of that. And like how much time is left in the round. But in other games, specifically MMOs, these are terrible at this.
Yeah.
They just have a bunch of screens all over your and you can barely see your character or what's going on in the game. Because there's text here, and there's a map here, and there's several different health and other bars and stuff in this other section, and like you can't even tell
what the stock price is.
Yeah, right. You're joking, but some of them I think have that. Like, it's too much stuff.
Yeah.
So this is, yeah. So I'm just like, get rid of it all.
Uh huh.
We talked about this in a previous episode. I think this might have been one of the first ones we had. Where like in we had just been playing Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild,
mm-hmm.
and like I'm like promo it all the way,
oh yeah,
hear it all that mess, and Mark's like, no, I need some of this stuff. It's helpful. It's useful. And
yeah.
I'm like, eh.
Right. So the problem I have is
mm-hmm.
like I don't understand where you're coming from exactly.
Okay.
Like, is it just that you don't want the visual clutter? Is it that it doesn't feel realistic? Like, what is exactly your problem?
I think it's
the problem,
Steven. What is
it? No, I mean, because like when you say like, it was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It's cluttered and noisy. But like, I'm still not hearing a real reason as to why it feels that way.
I think it's largely just because like, oftentimes the HUDs just, they feel like distractions.
Yeah.
They just feel like a bunch of noise that you don't really need to pay attention mm-hmm. to.
So like I guess we can talk about Zelda because mm-hmm. but like what is the example of the piece of HUD you don't need?
Well, like the temperature stuff, you don't need that. Most of the time it tells you in the game, you're too cold, you're too hot.
Right.
So like,
that's true. Link goes, ah,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And like it makes a noise.
Yeah. And you start taking damage over time and like you'll shiver if it's
right.
too cold and there's a blast of cold air in your face
mm-hmm.
when you start getting too cold.
Right. That's when you've crossed the barrier from pretty cold to too cold.
Yes.
But what if you want to know, what if you want to prevent that from happening?
I mean, you wait until it happens and then put on your warm coat.
Right, but what, I mean, certainly a lot of people role play when they play Zelda.
Sure.
Like, what if you want to be prepared for every scenario and not just be like, walk into a tundra and go, oh, I should probably put a shirt on. Like,
if you know you're
going... What if you want to go there with...
I mean, I think that's true, but I think if you're going into a cold place, you put on your coat before you get there.
Yeah, but how do you know it's... How do you know how cold it is? It's like it's cold at night in the desert. Like you don't know that unless like, cause there's no temperature. There's no heater that comes with your Switch to give you that feeling. And this is where I definitely differ from you.
Peripheral idea.
Yeah. This is where I think people get really when they're like, oh, I don't want any mini map. I don't want any of this stuff. Like I think people get this idea of like, it's about realism.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a problem because these are metaphors for the experience your player is having, just like hit points are. And so I think that we too easily forget that, like, that's what it's doing. It's doing what the character in that world would understand or know.
Yeah.
And it explains to you, the player, in a way that you can understand and know.
Right.
And
it's the realism thing is not a side I'm going to take because, like, whatever. Yeah.
Realism. But like maybe you don't need the temperature gauge mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can always, because like as soon as you're too cold, it doesn't take health off right away.
Yeah,
I would guess they probably iterated versions where it did.
Oh, probably.
In where you would need to be more cognizant of that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about actually playing as Link, walking through this world, wouldn't you want to always know how hot and cold it is? Like if you're thinking of how realistic it is.
I guess like if I was thinking of it, I'll. Because I don't play with the thing on in Zelda, so I don't have a good example. But I had there's a mod in Skyrim you can add where like it's called hypothermia or something.
Yeah.
Where like it'll cause sections of the map to be too cold or too hot. And, like, you got to be prepared for it.
Yep.
If I'm planning on going to a cold location, I will make sure to wear warm clothes before I go to that location.
Yeah.
Instead of, and if I start getting too cold, then, like, there is a little notification that pops up, but, like, mm-hmm. it comes in for a second and then goes away.
Yeah.
And, like, that will just tell me, oh, I need to put on my warm clothes. So, like, I guess that's what I need from it. I don't need to necessarily feel like I am the character feeling cold.
Yeah.
I just need to know that the character I'm playing as is too cold at this moment, and then I just switch clothes.
Okay. So thinking of the indicator you get in Zelda when you're too cold, one of the fun things about it is it's diegetic.
Yeah.
Like Link shivers.
That was the word I was looking for earlier, diegetic.
But not only does he shiver, but like particles fly off of him.
Yeah.
Right? Not realistic.
I mean,
but
yeah.
that's a HUD element.
Right.
It just happens to be diegetic, right?
Yes.
So, like, would you be okay if it was more like your Skyrim mod where it was just a little warning thing that popped up on the screen and then went away?
Mm-hmm.
And Link looked more realistically how it would look. Would that be okay?
Yeah, that would be better because it's not constantly distracting. It's only there when you need to know it's there.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it is. It's like especially with MMOs, there's a lot of distracting noise all over the screen, and not all of it is relevant. And in fact, most of it might not be relevant for most of the game.
It's like contextual HUD.
Yes. I like contextual HUDs a lot better. Like Hollow Knight does this pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you collect things, then you see how much of that collectible you have. You don't need to see the collectible constantly because that's not relevant when you aren't buying stuff or you aren't selling
Wait,
stuff.
You mean like Geo?
Yeah, Geo.
You always have your Geo count
no,
in the
it's,
corner.
No, it's not always. Is it always up?
It's always up there.
Well, it shouldn't be.
What you're talking about is that when you collect a bunch, it shows how many you just collected before for a couple seconds before adding it to your total.
Yeah.
Which is a way for you so you don't have to be constantly staring at your count.
Yeah.
That's a good piece of UI design.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always up there.
You don't need it up there all the time.
Right, because the shop is like so far away.
Right. There's not that many. Yeah, the shop is
in one spot. Yeah, but if you're saving up for something, you're going to need to know, like, oh, I need to defeat like 3 more bugs to get 200.
Well, then press the start button and look at it on there.
That's a lot of work when I'm like, should I go back up or not? You have to keep pressing start all the time?
I suppose.
I guess that's where I don't understand like your the ideology you have about it. It's like, it's not hurting anybody. It's not taking up the space. And then it's available for the player who wants it when they want it. The game is not making an assumption about when you want
it
or need it.
It's distracting for the player that does not want it.
Uh-huh. See that? Problem. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Okay. Well, it's just
because you didn't even notice that it was there.
Yeah, you want it to be distracting, but it's in fact not.
It well, wasn't at all because you didn't even notice it.
That's true. That the Geo thing, I did not notice, and so I can be wrong sometimes.
Haha.
But not in this case. HUD sucks. Okay. I'm just taking a stand. I guess this is where I die. This hill. Like I said, the Geo thing, I guess I literally just did not notice that. But like in other cases, they'll constantly have your health bar and stuff on it and stuff. Like with Skyrim, I have that stuff fade out.
Yeah.
After you, like, it's not visible or hasn't changed in a while.
Right.
And sometimes, admittedly, it's too not visible because sometimes I have like 2/3 of my health and I want it filled all the way, but like it's gone. So I don't know that I'm at 2/3 health.
Right. Right.
So like in those situations, then I just press start and check my...
And I'm thinking about... I don't play Skyrim, but like Skyrim is not a constant going from battle to battle kind of game. A lot of it is just, walking around to the next thing.
Yep.
And so that would make more sense to have a HUD that fades away because there's... Because the developer can be more confident that you don't... in the opportunities which you would need to see that information.
Yeah.
Right, I mean the modder rather than the developer, I suppose. But so I think it really does depend on the type of game.
It totally does.
Like you started off by just defending fighting games, but like I could totally see a type of fighting game where not knowing your health would be an interesting mechanic.
There is, I brought it up the other day. Last time we recorded, mm-hmm. I can't remember what it was called, but Shaolin Showdown.
It's like depending on what limb you get hit on or something like that.
That one doesn't have a health bar in it.
Right.
But like it's clear when you're...
It uses different indicators. Mm-hmm. But I could see like a type of Street Fighter where you just do not know. You just have to guess like based on how many hits you think you took. Like that would be...
That's the Moonfields.
Oh, I surprised, right. Well, that's just because that HUD is not... You can't see it. It's not...
I like that. We're both just stumbling over previous claims. This is great.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like
yeah,
it becomes a mechanical choice.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I could, it, it, it changes the mechanics of it. And I think it's not just about like, oh, it's distracting or I need it or I don't need it. Uh-huh. It's that it changes what the game is necessarily. And yeah, you brought up the Moonfields, which is a game by a friend of ours. Uh-huh. And Rafi, who develops it, he's incredibly anti-HUD. Like, uh-huh. He puts his foot down, like, uh-huh. more than you, I think.
Yeah.
And his is a game that, in my opinion, I mean, he gets to decide. Yeah. But in my opinion, I think it needs a little bit of indication for how many like health points you have.
Yeah.
And he has these like diegetic indicators. Which I don't think a lot of people see very well. And he's doing a lot of work to try to make that work for it.
Yeah.
So like, he knows. He's not like ignoring the issue.
Right.
But like, I think that ideology maybe prevents him from coming up with a solution that like, he's making it harder on himself.
Sure.
You know? And I think he knows that. And
yeah.
He's going with it eyes open.
Yeah. but I think that the Moonfields is a good example, because the way that health works in Moonfields is when you take damage, there's no health bar or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But like, your character starts blinking a little bit more frequently.
Right.
And the more health you have, or the more health you are missing, the more frequently it will blink.
Yeah.
And so in order for you to actually pay attention to that, you have to like stand still for a moment and see what's up.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
like,
well, the goal is to, in fact, communicate to you.
Yeah.
And so it's doing the job of a HUD element, just not as well. And at the like, in order to maintain the purity of not having a piece of HUD.
Well, no, but not just that, but like, it also is a part of like the game as a result of you yeah. having to sit there and pay attention to
oh,
it. Like,
it has become that.
Yeah.
I don't know that was the intention.
Oh, well. Okay, maybe it wasn't.
But I guess
we'll have to have Rafi on
well,
the
you know, no, it's, and I, yeah. I would totally guess that Rafi has leaned into that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because yeah. he's certainly noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
And now that becomes a part of it. And mm-hmm. like, a lot of choices you make as a designer can be like, for whatever reason. Like,
yeah.
you don't have to have a good reason for a choice you make.
True.
As long as you recognize it and then move forward with it. And I think he's done that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, the idea that it is not just an ideology, it actually does mechanically change what you're doing.
Yeah.
And when I hear those, I think you know better, and I think Rafi knows better, but I think a lot of people who make this argument of like, you know, clear off my screen, I don't want to be distracted.
Yeah.
Whenever I hear that argument, I don't hear it in any other context, but that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's can be kind of annoying.
Sure.
because like, a lot of times games benefit from adding a piece of HUD, like, and that becomes more clear and
yeah.
less distracting and more like a simpler for people to understand, even if it is there are visually more things happening. And I think people don't understand that like they think of it too on one dimensionally, I suppose.
Sure.
You know? Like, an example is in Metro Nexus, in my game, there was a charging mechanic where as you charge your weapon by pulling off energy off the ground,
yeah.
your sort of cannon that is in front of your car gets longer.
Uh-huh.
And the longer it is, the more powerful your weapon is. And I didn't intend that to be something that people needed to know exactly how important that was, because I didn't intend for people to really be precise about how much they charge their weapon exactly.
Yeah.
And I assumed more that they would see how many tiles of energy they picked up off the ground, and that's a much bigger space on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be more their guide of how much they charge.
And that's kind of more important to the game too, right?
Right.
Like, picking up stuff.
Exactly right. But players didn't really keep track of that. Even I thought they would, but they didn't. And what I ended up having to do was I ended up putting a piece of HUD underneath the car that's just a little bar that charges up, and I was like loath to do it.
Uh-huh.
Because it's like it's extra like clutter, and visual clutter is something that like I have trouble with.
Uh-huh.
I want it to look nice, and when
yeah.
in a game where it's like four players running all over the screen, it's hard to know how it's always going to look.
Yeah.
And so that's something I've been trying to be very careful to calibrate. But as soon as I put that on there, players started understanding the game better. And I asked them, people who playtested before and after, I said, like, is it okay that it's sort of extra visually cluttered? And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, they literally didn't even notice there was an extra thing there now. And I still was like, oh, it's still an extra thing. But I don't know. I feel like that's in, at least, and I'm biased because it's, you know, but I feel like it's a success story.
Yeah.
Of, like, adding a bunch of junk, it makes it simpler and cleaner.
Sure.
And I think it's true more often than anybody's willing to admit.
Okay.
Then yeah. Steven is willing to admit.
Okay, it's maybe like 5% sometimes better.
I'll take it.
Like 3%.
Uh-huh.
Or 0%.
Ooh.
Okay, it's not 0%. Yeah, I mean, I will admit that every once in a while it is nice to have a thing up on
yeah.
the screen so that like you know what's up. And like it's helpful not just for like people who are playing the game, people who aren't, because sometimes it's hard to tell what the heck is going on because there's not enough stuff on the screen.
Yeah.
Like, that's a part of the reason why I don't like watching, like, professional League of Legends and stuff,
mm-hmm.
is because I can't tell what's going on a lot of the times, especially in, like, team fights.
Uh-huh.
So
speaking of games with a lot of HUD.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know, I think the best games that do like a lack of HUD well are ones that are really designed for that. I'm thinking about Clawbreaker, where like there isn't a health bar because you just lose one arm and then lose the other arm.
Yeah.
And like it's designed for that. Like if it had more complicated mechanics, it would require a more complicated layout.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I think the problem comes when it's more than you need or less than you need.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just determining what you need is the challenge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It depends on what's important and what you think the player needs to know.
Yeah.
At certain times or all the time.
What games do it really well? Like, what are the ones that like get your seal of approval?
Well, I was gonna say Hollow Knight, but now I feel like a hypocrite. But it does give you the information you need all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you're in combat fairly regularly, so like showing your health, and showing how much mana you have and stuff, basically all the time is makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it was unobtrusive enough that you didn't even notice it when you didn't need to notice it. So
yeah. So I would have to say Hollow Knight.
Steven, seal of approval. trying to think of good games that I've really liked the HUDs on.
Mm-hmm.
I like Borderlands's
because
it's just the mini map. I like Breath of the Wild with all the things.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love the aesthetic of that. I think we even talked about it. Like there was parts of it I didn't love totally, but I just love that clean white graphical look on this fantasy environment, because I normally hate like the fantasy gizmos that are always filling these HUDs, but the Breath of the Wild is just gorgeous looking.
I like, but it like brought up my sort of like must have things in order tendencies, because I had to get, you can't just have part of a stamina wheel. Like, you have to have a full circle. And then if you get another part, you have to get a full another circle. Otherwise, no. It's not okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mario Odyssey, also similarly clean aesthetic, and it had tons of HUD. Like, it was explaining things to you constantly.
Oh, that's why.
With little, like, tiny inset videos.
Yeah.
And it was all good.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even remember there being any HUD, but it's largely just because things will pop up contextually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything... Is there anything on the screen otherwise?
Yeah.
I don't know.
All the moons you have.
Is that always
the
there?
The coins you have.
Oh, boy. Wow. Okay. So here's the
You just have no HUD mode turned off on your brain.
Yeah, I guess. The lesson I've learned today is that if you don't notice the HUD, then it's good. But and you have all the information you need, then it's good.
Yeah. One of the things Mario Odyssey does that probably helps with this is the camera is set back pretty far for a 3D Mario game.
Oh.
And so you tend to look at more the center of the screen, and so the things that are on the outside, including the HUD, tend to fall outside your view in terms of your perception more than they would, say, in an older game that were on smaller televisions and lower resolutions.
Yeah.
And so I think it's probably true of... Well, I think Zelda's probably really... The camera's pretty much the same it's been in previous ones.
Okay.
But I feel like Mario Odyssey, so that you are looking at the edges of the screen a lot less than you were in previous games.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. I like that. That did make sense as to why I don't remember any of that.
Any other game you want to like just destroy and leave on the battlefield before we take this just episode?
MMOs, too many windows, turn them off.
Yeah.
I leave it on that.
You heard it here, folks. That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app, and be sure to give it a good review if you liked it, or a nice like us. We really need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club. Lastly, you can find more about the show, your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
They tell stories.
Yeah.
And I find that so interesting.
Yeah, there's the snow one or whatever. One where you go down an incline. I don't remember the most of it. But yeah, it tells a story.
Where you go down an incline.
Yes. That's all I remember. Uh-huh. There's like parts where trees are falling and you can hop off of them. And then there's a part where there's you're in a cave or ice cave or something and snow.
Uh-huh. Real memorable.
Yes. I swear it exists.